Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Say 1906 to anyone in the earth sciences or longtime residents of the San Francisco Bay Area, and you need say no more. They know exactly what you mean, the Great Northern California Earthquake. Striking shortly after 5 a.m. in the morning on April 18th, it was nearly a magnitude 8 at the upper boundary of what the San Andreas Fault is capable of unleashing. It led to the severing of gas and water lines, igniting fires that would destroy most of the city of San Francisco. And at that time, San Francisco was the center of commerce and power on the West Coast. After the quake, Los Angeles began the rapid growth that shifted much of that power to Southern California. It's fascinating now to visit the beautiful city by the bay and see some of the few remaining buildings from that time, like Mission Dolores in the Mission District or the Officers Club in the Presidio. In this concluding program of our two-part look back at the 1906 earthquake, we'll find out about how the United States Geological Survey is using the tools of social science to better communicate with us before, during, and after a damaging earthquake with Sarah McBride. She's a social scientist with the USGS Geologic Hazard Science Center in Golden, Colorado. We'll also hear about how the early warning shake alert system will help us all be better prepared and save lives when the next big one strikes with Robert DeGroot, operations team lead for the USGS shake alert program. But first, we're joined once again by Susan Huff. Susan is a geophysicist at the United States Geological Survey's Earthquake Science Center in Pasadena. I asked Susan about how science responded in the immediate aftermath of the 1906 quake.
Yeah, so there's a big story in the scientific impact of 1906. But to set the stage, you know, to learn from earthquakes, the earthquakes have to happen, but the scientific community has to be ready to observe them and collect data because they're ephemeral phenomena. So, and then you have to have the framework to understand what you're looking at. So I've been doing a lot of work on an earthquake in 1886 in Charleston that was just before people understood the association between earthquakes and faulting. And there were some very astute geologists out making observations, but they didn't know what they were looking at, and they didn't understand the significance of a sideways movement of a railroad track. So 1906 happened at a time when there were trained geologists in the area, and they were able to go out and collect various sorts of data, including before versus after leveling data. And so the stage was sort of set for scientific advancements. It was after 1906 that it was really established just how big the San Andreas was. So that was an important step. They didn't understand it was a plate boundary, but they followed the entire and mapped the entire structure. So that was done. One of the most important studies was done by a scientist named Reed, who looked at leveling data. So before the earthquake, there'd been leveling surveys, and you could establish pretty precisely the relative positioning of different points on Earth. You know, it's just basically surveying techniques. And then they went out after 1906 and resurveyed. And then you could see how the ground had moved. So not a seismogram, but you could see that, you know, this benchmark had moved this way and this benchmark had moved that way. And from that, Reed was able to work out what we call elastic rebound theory. And that was one of the key, if you want to understand earthquakes, that was one of the key puzzle pieces, that the two sides of a fault are locked and stresses build up over time. And then in the earthquake, you get a lurching of the two sides of the fault and the process we call elastic rebound. So that came out of 1906 and may have been the single most important scientific discovery.
It's interesting to think about, where were some of the greatest offsets? You know, how big were they? Were, you know, like fences broke and things like that? And how many feet was the greatest offsets recorded in by the studies?
Well, yeah, I don't have all of those numbers off the top of my head. I'm pretty sure there was at least 6 meters of offset in some places. So that would have been on the order of 18 feet. But I would have to look back to remember all the detailed numbers. And typically the fault doesn't break the same amount everywhere, and especially at the surface, because you have this variability where the fault is coming up through these shallow materials. You can get more slip in some areas than others, or in some areas you have fault branches, and in other areas it's more of a single simple structure. So there can be quite a bit of variability along a long break.
So that's why, like in Marin County, there were the really big offsets on some of those farm fences, and the historic pictures of that Grove Carl Gilbert took that included Alice Eastwood in them, looking across the fault. And that's why those were so big compared to some of the other places. It's just the nature of the ground.
Yeah, for, earthquakes they're kind of like snowflakes. The way the fault breaks is always different in detail. In 1992, there was a magnitude 7.3 in the California desert that it broke, and then it kind of jumped to another fault and then had like a second pulse of energy. So if you look at how the ground broke, it sort of looked like a two-hump camel. So in that case, it started to peter out, but then was able to jump and keep going. And so you always see complexity. For 1906, it may well have been more complex than we know, because the data were so limited. You could only tease out really the first order properties of the rupture.
And are you familiar with the story of Alice Eastwood and Grove Carl Gilbert and the earthquake?
Yeah, I am a little bit. So, you know, they were both interesting characters. Gilbert was amazing. I talked about how people didn't really understand what an earthquake was until it was really around 1891. There was a big earthquake in Japan, and scientists worked out that the fault break had actually caused the ground to shake. And you know, before then, that understanding really hadn't gelled. But if you go back to what Gilbert was saying before then, like the 1880s, he was basically talking about the earthquake cycle and looking at the Wasatch fault system in Utah. He was talking about how stress built up on faults and then was released in earthquakes. And then the stress needed to build again, but it was really nearly prescient. In my view, that he understood something that he didn't really have the framework to even understand. But there was just a very deep, intuitive understanding.
Interesting. For you, as a contemporary USGS seismologist, you know, what are some of the things that, you know, are important to you when you look back at, you know, the advancement of earthquake science? And do we still have stuff we can learn from 1906, even now?
Oh, I'm sure there is. And for me as a scientist, and I'm a little more historically oriented than some of my colleagues, I find the lore and the stories fascinating as well. And one aspect of 1906 was, you know, sort of part of the shift of away from earthquakes as acts of God and viewing them as natural phenomenon that you need to prepare for and respond to. And there was a wonderful little poem that was published. In the aftermath of the earthquake, if, as they say, God spanked the town for being over frisky, why did he burn the churches down and save Hodling's whiskey?
There's
one of the bits of lore was that Hodling's whiskey distillery was in danger once the fires got going. And with a series of heroic efforts, they were able to first protect the building, and then eventually they moved whiskey barrels out to a vacant lot and they protected the. And so, yeah, the whiskey was saved. But it's a bit of lore that kind of, there's more to it than a cute poem. 1906 was part of people were moving away from viewing earthquakes as acts of God and, you know, viewing them as a natural phenomenon that you could both prepare for and, you know, respond to. And part of that, you know, implicit in that poem, people knew that it was people who really saved Hodling's whiskey. And, you know, you're just, you know, moving towards an acknowledgement of, you know, of the need for preparedness and effective earthquake response and all that in a cute little home.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting to think back to 1906. It's that's the time of transition. You see those famous films, like the film Going Down Market Street, two days before the earthquake, where you can see it's an era where the automobile is coming in, and but there's still horses on the street. So you're in that transition period from horse-drawn vehicles to automobiles.
Yeah, I noticed that too, that I don't think of, you know, a lot of cars being around in 1906, but there were already some. And in San Francisco, Market Street is recognizable. And it's very different, but, you know, the city existed and the scientific community existed. So it was smaller and the, you know, the instrumentation was less sophisticated. There were no computers, but you had, you know, everything had moved to a point where, you know, when the earthquake happened, you didn't just, you know, marvel and boggle at the shaking, but people were able to really dig in and start to understand it.
Well, Susan Huff from the USGS, we really appreciate you joining us to talk about the 1906 earthquake and the San Andreas Fault and give us some perspective on the history of this incredible event in Northern California.
Sure. It's been fun talking to you.
Thanks to our guest, geophysicist from the United States Geological Survey's Earthquake Science Center in Pasadena, California, Susan Huff. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the massive earthquake that struck Northern California in 1906. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to part two of Blue Dot's special look at the 1906 Northern California earthquake on the San Andreas Fault that led to the near total destruction of San Francisco as well as Santa Rosa and major damage throughout Northern California. Now let's turn our attention to the societal impacts of major earthquakes like the 1906 event. Our guest is Sarah McBride. Sarah is a social scientist with the USGS Geologic Hazard Science Center in Golden, Colorado. Sarah McBride, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And we're talking about the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and its implications for us today. But first, what I'd like to know is what got you interested in earthquakes in general, and then the social science aspects of that in particular?
Well, I've been interested in extreme earth events since I was a child. I grew up in the shadow of Mount St. Helens, the eruption. It impacted my family who were living in Eastern Washington at the time. And I grew up with stories of ash fall and the sky turning black from that eruption. And it created a real fascination for me as a child. I memorized all the volcanoes in the Cascade Range, and I knew their eruption dates, if that information was available, and their basic geology. I would say interest in earthquakes specifically came much later with three events. Loma Prieta, which impacted my family who were living in the Bay. My aunt and uncle were living at the Bay in the Bay at the time. And then Nisqually in Seattle. I grew up in Washington State, so I actually felt Nisqually. And then some earthquakes that were very shallow in Spokane, where I was living in 2001. And so those three events really got me interested in earthquakes.
And when I mention 1906, what comes to mind for you?
Well, I think 1906 is really interesting on a lot of levels. It's a very cinematic event, right? You know, when we think about it from a media perspective, in 1906 was really the beginning of the rise of mass communication, where we're looking at the availability of film, for example, and wireless messages, not what we think of wireless today, obviously, but, you know.
Telegraph.
Yes, exactly. A telegraph and photographs. And it really gave rise. It was such a media saturated event when we didn't have those kinds of capabilities, say for the Charleston earthquake in the 1870s, or for the New Madrid events that occurred in 1811 and 1812 that impacted large parts of the United States. We just didn't have that ability to capture the public's imagination the way that 1906 did, and subsequent years of dramatization with film and recording. And I think it goes deep into the roots of the identity of California, San Francisco having been in 1906 such an economic hub for financial wealth and growth in California, and seeing the infrastructure and the buildings that were coming up, and then seeing that really destroyed from the earthquake and subsequent fire. I think it does have this cinematic feel to it. This, when we talk about the big one, I think a lot of people think about the San Francisco 1906 earthquake. And it isn't the largest earthquake recorded in the United States, not by a long shot, but it certainly is one that I think has stuck into the imagination, Californians in particular, but I think for a lot of people in the United States when they think about big earthquakes.
Yeah, and they even made a Hollywood movie about it, San Francisco.
1936 with Clark Gable. Yes, it's a very famous one. And it's a really interesting film on a lot of levels. And I think this is just a side note, Dave, you don't have to add this, it's just kind of conversational, but I think San Francisco, the movie, actually is what all disaster films have been followed a certain blueprint when it comes to like the addition of a background romance and a hero and the event sort of mid movie and, the protagonist struggling through these large events. Titanic, you can see, has very similar plot notes as San Francisco, the movie. And I think it really did lay out that blueprint for disaster movies to come.
In the aftermath of 1906, the actual earthquake, there was considerable denial going on with the powers that be, business interests, political interests, that they wanted to downplay the aspect of the earthquake and just make it out as it was just a fire. And I'm curious about that kind of human denial mechanism that happens for people that live in earthquake country. And California is earthquake country. Do you notice anything like that still today?
I would say that I think Californians, the people who have lived here for a period of time, accept that earthquakes are a part of your experience. Most Californians who've lived in California for a long period of time, they've felt shaking of some sort, and there is an acceptance of the existence of that. I think the difference between, say, the fires and the earthquake is that earthquakes feel so powerless. They come suddenly, often without very little warning, even though now we have earthquake early warning, we have shake alert. They make you feel incredibly powerless. I've been in an earthquake that was the same magnitude as the San Francisco earthquake, a 7.8. And that experience had a profound impact on me to be near that shaking and to really understand and feel that shaking and really understand how ferocious the earth can be.
Where was that, Sarah?
That was in New Zealand. It was in
Christchurch.
No, it was the Kaikoura earthquake. Kaikoura North Hauranui earthquake in 2016. I was in Wellington, the capital of New Zealand at the time. I experienced MMI 7 shaking, just for those of people who want to know the intensity of that, for about a minute and a half. It was a very intense experience. And so I have profound empathy for people who go through very large earthquakes. You almost sort of develop a mistrust of the earth after that. The earth, it's something you always trust, right? Like you walk on the earth, you feel it, it's always there, it's always stable, and suddenly it behaves like water. It behaves like something else entirely. And you sort of kind of just don't trust the earth. And it feels like something so fundamental you should be able to do is to trust the earth underneath you.
Yeah, that the solid earth beneath your feet is something we are all accustomed to. And when it's not, that is really a traumatic event. I'm curious about you as a social scientist working for the USGS. You know, messaging from scientists and the authorities in the aftermath of a big earthquake, any disaster, it's really important. What are some of your views on like the best practices now for dealing with a major disaster in the aftermath of that to help people?
Well, I think there's sort of best practices when it comes to wording and specific advice. There's best practices when it comes to tone and style and timing and channels. So there's a number of things that go into it. You know, messaging is one part of the equation, but there's actually a number other of component parts, timing being a huge aspect of when a message can and will be received. What we know about people who experience earthquakes is that trauma and trauma responses can occur, particularly in a pretty rigorous aftershock sequence. And so what that looks like is people then stop being able to understand complex information that you give them. So one of the things that I've worked on, which is the aftershock forecast, we start out very simple because the aftershock forecast is a probabilistic blueprint of basically of futures that could happen regarding the earthquake and the aftershocks related to this earthquake. And we basically say, be ready for more earthquakes right off the bat. Because if people cannot understand, they're too traumatized, or they're really overwhelmed with information and they can't understand the numbers we're about to tell them, we start first with the most important thing that they need to know, which is that more earthquakes will be coming. And for them to help get them around accepting that this is the new reality.
Yeah, I remember experiencing the 1971 San Fernando earthquake. And the aftershocks, you know, after a little while, since I had a pretty good fundamental understanding of what earthquakes were, even though I was only 11 years old, and what was causing it, and that it was just the earth, and that it would, you know, eventually be okay, and that our house was fine. But we had people that had evacuated because there was a dam that could have failed north of us, and they came to our house. And their daughter, every time there was an aftershock, she just, you know, absolutely went bananas. She was screaming and crying, and I would try to calm her down. So we all have different responses in that, you know, post-trauma period.
That's right. And you really don't know how you're going to cope with an earthquake until it occurs. It is a profoundly disorienting experience, as you know, Dave, from your own personal experience.
And certainly.
I'll tell you how I responded with Kaikoura, if this is any help at all. I remember waking up in the middle of the night. It was midnight. My partner at the time, he woke me up and he said, you know, there's really heavy shaking and you're on call. So I was on call for GNS science at the time. And I remember thinking three things very clearly in that moment. One was that this is very long and strong tsunami, because New Zealand's population, particularly in that area, there's a lot of population on the waterfront and near the water. And I was very concerned about tsunami. Number two was, I had been working in earthquakes now at that point for almost 15 years. And that earthquake felt so large and I felt so small in that moment. I did not know how I was going to be able to get through that night. And number three was, I'm in my nightgown and I'm not wearing any pants. And I need to find my pants. And I got out of bed, which is what you're not supposed to do, to look for my pants. And I totally lost all vision of what my job was in that moment and what I was supposed to do. And I didn't take the advice. And my partner looked at me and he was like, what are you doing? Get in bed. And I said, no, I can't do my job without my pants. And he said, your pants are on the floor, get in bed and pull yourself together. Because if you're not together and you're the public information manager for GNS Science, which is the USGS for New Zealand, then New Zealand's going to lose it. So you have to keep yourself together. And so that really helped get me into focus. But, you know, even me with all the training and the education, and I had been in aftershocks in Christchurch, even then, I still found an earthquake that was overwhelming for me. So I have a lot of compassion and empathy for when people don't know what to do with earthquakes, when they're faced with that moment, that actual shaking, and they go, oh, what am I supposed to do? Because even me, an expert, struggled in that moment.
And I would add to that, that there's a lot of people that have experienced earthquakes, but not on that level of shaking here in California. And unless you've been in a magnitude 6.5 or larger earthquake, and most people haven't, you just don't know what that's like. It's impossible to describe to someone. So like you said, it's like something, when you're experiencing it, it's a whole different ball game than what you think it might be like.
That's right. That's right. You think you know how you're going to respond, and you think you're going to be cool. And sometimes you surprise yourself. I've also been surprised with people who I thought maybe wouldn't respond as well, and they did great. So you don't know how you're going to respond. And aftershocks, and I'm glad you mentioned your neighbor's daughter, aftershocks are really interesting because when you've already experienced that initial shake, that initial really, really, really big shake, that's one thing. But then aftershocks are a constant reminder of that initial shake. So it becomes very hard to heal and to move on from an event that you are constantly reminded by shaking. Plus, you don't know when the shaking is going to get worse, right? You know, you've been through earthquakes, Dave. You know that, you know, you might feel a little bit of shaking here and there, and you're like, is this going to get worse? Is this not going to get worse? And you don't, it's really hard to, you know, be able to let your guard down. And let's say you're someone in Christchurch and you experience this day in and day out for 2 or 3 years where you're experiencing shaking that you're feeling for a very long time. It really can. And the evidence is from research, from psychology studies done in Christchurch, indicates that about 25% of the population of Christchurch experienced some form of mental health disruption due to the aftershock sequence and That's earthquakes.
Understandable. Like you said, it's when the very earth beneath your feet, something that you're so used to being solid, suddenly becomes very unreliable. That's just a hard thing to cope with. Okay, let's talk about preparing.
Sure.
Because you know that's something everybody knows they should do. What if you live in California, you should be prepared for an earthquake wherever you live, because all of California has faults traveling through it. And we also have wildfires and, you know, natural disasters of various kinds. And we all should be prepared. And yet, you know, so many of us that, you know, we think in the back of our minds, yeah, I got to do that, but then we don't. So tell us about what are some, you know, professional tips for how to, you know, really be prepared for a disaster.
Well, first, I want to go back just a second to talk about why people don't prepare. Because I think that to me is a real question that we, that social scientists have, right? And it's a classic case of what we would define as the knowledge behavior gap. And the knowledge behavior gap is pretty self-explanatory. We know what to do. Awareness in California, we know from even recent studies, awareness in California amongst Californians is very high in terms of acceptance that a large damaging earthquake could occur near people and impact their lives. So people know this. This is not a question of awareness. What is the issue is the changing and modification of behavior. It's like, we all know that physical exercise, for those of us who can do it and are physically able to do it, we know that it's beneficial for our health and our mental health and our social health to do those things. But how many of us actually do what is recommended by our physicians and health practitioners? A lot of us don't, right? There's several aspects of this. One is the worry budget that people have, right? So we all have a certain amount of things that you and I, Dave, can worry about. I know it feels endless, the amount of things that we can worry about, especially, you know, given today's environment and all the news that comes through. But we actually have a worry budget of things we can worry about on a day-to-day basis and things we can do about. So one fissure of this, or one aspect of this, is that with our worry budget, people may look at the 1906 earthquake, or they may look at really large, other really large damaging earthquakes, and they think, gosh, that is so huge and so scary, and I'm so small. I don't even know how to begin to prepare for an event like that. I'm just going to hope that it doesn't happen in my lifetime, or I'm going to rely on government officials to help me out. So they kind of move into a state of almost positive fatalism, right? Like they just trust it's going to be okay because it feels so big that there's nothing that they can do about it. The other aspect of the behavior that goes along with the worry budget is that people are just fundamentally busy these days. You know, we have jam-packed lives with lots of different other priorities. And to prepare for an earthquake when you have to take the kids to school, or you got to pick up your kids from soccer practice, or you have to go and work, or go see friends or family members or have other commitments, and to have someone sit down and go, okay, today I'm going to prepare for an earthquake. It's really hard to break into someone's normal daily life and go, yes, this is actually really important, and this is something that we think you should do on a daily basis. So those are some of the attributes that we know around why people don't prepare. The third reason, and this is a really interesting emergent part of the research, is that there's an argument that even preparedness takes a certain amount of financial wealth to be able to do. And let's say you live in a tiny apartment. Where are you going to store all of your supplies that you're supposed to have for 2 weeks or 3 days even? Where are you supposed to afford all the extra food lying around or all the extra kit that people think that they need in order to prepare for an earthquake? So there's a conversation going on in my field around it being, you know, preparedness is actually an aspect of privilege, and understanding that not everybody can be as prepared as what we might want them to be.
Okay, well, what are some simple things that, you know, we can all do to get prepared?
So the way that I like to talk about preparedness is less about a physical kit and more about thinking laterally about what's in your environment already and small things you can do that can make really important changes based on what we know about injury data and survival. So one of the things that's really small, but one of the things is having a pair of shoes or slippers
just under your bed.
Under your bed, because we know from Northridge that a lot of people, it was at 4 a.m., the power went out, people couldn't see where the broken glass was. They went to get up to either go and help their children or go and take a look at what would happen to their house. They went up, they didn't look at where they were going, and they walked on broken glass, and there was an enormous amount of foot injuries.
Yes.
In there. So, and then people fell over and then injured themselves from there. I'm not laughing because it's funny, but you know.
No, but it really does happen.
So, and that's really simple in terms of just even some, just maybe you're going to donate that footwear, just put it under your bed or put it next to your bed, someplace close by. I always have footwear near my bed, even in Colorado, where earthquakes are not expected anytime soon. I always, just out of habit of living in various parts of the world where earthquakes happen, I keep shoes next to my bed all the time. The other thing I keep next to my bed all the time is some sort of alternate light source. So a flashlight of any kind, something that I can just grab. And that helps for any event. You know, we lose power in the middle of the night, and being able to see if we can is really important. So that's one thing that's fairly affordable that we can do. In terms of food and food storage, what I like to do is just keep a little bit of extra food around that I like to eat. So one of the things that's important around food storage is, you know, if you're going through a disaster, you don't want to eat a bunch of food that you're not familiar with and your digestive system doesn't know and you're not going to want to eat. And so just keeping extra of dried or canned or easy cook foods that you already like is actually a pretty good idea. So just already having just extra put aside rather than having to put it in a spare box if you don't have the room in your house. If you really want to get a gold star and do all that, yeah, sure, I'm going to encourage you. But even a basic is just, you know, grabbing an extra couple of cans of food that you like and you want to eat and start building a little bit of an excess supply in your cupboards already is pretty helpful. The other thing in terms of preparedness and injury, a lot of people, because we have pretty good construction standards in California, a lot of people have been injured by things falling on top of them. So bracing, you know, bookshelves, not having heavy things over your bed where you're sleeping or things that can fall on top of you is a really good idea. So just being situationally aware. So knowing what's in your environment and knowing what could harm you if it fell down or fell down at you at speed is actually another really easy thing that most people can do without having to invest a lot of time and effort in doing it. So that's another thing that I would recommend. And I think water is always a really critical thing in all kinds of disasters. So having access to fresh water or having an ability to make sure that your water is clean is always another good tip or good rule of thumb in terms of preparedness.
Yeah, solid advice. Well, Sarah McBride, before we let you go, what do you most enjoy about your work? What do you find most rewarding about your work on this?
I will be honest and say that I think I have the best job in the world. I love working to help people, particularly with earthquakes, and using my research knowledge, working with other social scientists to develop best practice advice, like we've been talking about today, and really understanding it very, very keenly in the way that physical science has received such funding and support. Also having a social science component to it so that we really understand how the exact things that people can do to improve their situation in their lives when earthquakes strike.
Well, Sarah McBride, it's been a pleasure to talk to you about this important information. And thanks for contributing to our look back at 1906 and our look forward to what, you know, we know inevitably will happen again.
Thank you.
Thanks to our guest, USGS social scientist Sarah McBride. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue part two of Blue Dot's special look back and forward at the lessons learned and unresolved questions from the 1906 earthquake in Northern California. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot's look back at the 1906 earthquake that shook Northern California and led to the near total destruction of San Francisco. Our final guest is Robert DeGroot. Robert is the operations team lead for the United States Geological Survey's Shake Alert program, an early warning system designed to keep people as safe as possible right before an earthquake. Robert DeGroot, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, I've asked this of everyone, and I need to ask you, when I say 1906, what pops to mind?
I think of major transformation in the history of California when the city of San Francisco was completely transformed and the state was really in a place where it realized it was an earthquake country and all of this stuff started happening around earthquakes.
Yeah, it was just such a seminal event in the history of seismology in California, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about your work with Shake Alert. First of all, can you just give us an overview of what Shake Alert is, and then we'll talk about how it works.
Yes, Shake Alert is the earthquake early warning system for the West Coast of the United States. It serves over 50 million residents and visitors in California, Oregon, and Washington. And it works on the principle of detecting ground motion super fast, moving that information even faster to a processing center. There are three of them, one in the Bay Area, one in Southern California, and one in Seattle, processing that information super fast in a matter of seconds, and then providing information so that organizations like Google or Metrolink or Cedars-Sinai Hospital or BART can take that information and do things with it, like slow down trains, close water valves, send alerts to phones, open firehouse doors.
And how long has Shake Alert been around? Because I have it on my phone. It's gone off a few times, which has been very interesting. But how long have we had Shake Alert now?
We've had Shake Alert in industrial settings, like for setting off automated actions like BART, since the fall of 2018. But we didn't go live with public alerting to cell phones, for example, in California until 2019. Actually on the 30th anniversary of the Loma Prieta earthquake in October of 2019. And then we went live in Oregon and Washington in March and May of 2021. So it took a few years, but we're there and we're advancing and doing all kinds of great stuff.
And I know, like, you know, when you first launch something like this, there's going to be some, you know, hiccups and problems and things. What are some of the things that you've, you know, fine-tuned, you know, in the last few years to get it to where it is now?
I think it's really important to realize that Shake Alert is in a constant state of improvement. And we've learned, so with system performance, the technical side, of course, we've fine-tuned our algorithms that do earthquake detection, that process the information. We're in the process of adding new data sources like information from really high performance GPS systems to help add to the accuracy of the system. But I think the part that people don't talk about too much is that we've also improved the human interface. A lot of people talk about the technical sides, but we spend a lot of time thinking about how people interact with the Shake Alert system. So how do people respond to messages? What do they do? How can we optimize that human piece, the human reaction to what they get?
Can you give us some specific examples of that, of ways that it's become, you know, a better interface for people?
Yeah. So one of the things that we are trying to optimize, for example, is the idea of what should a message say? And so we've been working with social scientists, with folks at the University of Colorado and folks from Central Washington University and from other places who have basically given us the formula for what constitutes a message that tells people to do something. They can think about it quickly. They can interpret it. They know it's coming from a credible source, and then they take that action and they protect themselves. And so we're looking at that messaging piece about what information is going to get people to act quickly. And we're actually doing this study now where we're looking at CCTV information from various earthquakes to see what people are actually doing when they feel shaking from earthquakes. And we're learning a lot about what people do. And it's from those sorts of studies that we're going to be able to figure out better ways for people to take that action if they feel shaking, like they always have been, or if they get an alert that originates from the Shake Alert system.
Well, let's talk about how it exactly works. How does Shake Alert get triggered? How does it know that an earthquake is imminent?
Yeah, so we're in the process of finishing up the build out of 1,675 seismic stations across California, Oregon, and Washington. And about 1,100 of those stations are in California. And basically all those sensors do is they pick up ground motion. That's their sole purpose in life, is to figure out if the ground is wiggling or not. And once that information is collected, let's say the ground starts moving, it's collected and then it's moved really fast to one of the processing centers that we have, the three that are one in the Bay Area, one in Southern California, and one in Seattle. That information is processed over a matter of seconds. And what gets pushed out is an estimate. And the key word here is estimate, because just to think about the amount of data that the Shake Alert system is using to do its thing at the very beginning, like the first alert that goes out, is based on about the time that it takes for a couple of heartbeats, so about a second of information, allows us to do what we do. And those estimates tell us where that earthquake is, how big it could be, and also what the shaking might be around that earthquake. And we hand that information off to our partners, our technical partners like BART, like Google, and others, who then take that information and decide, this is where we need to deliver alerts to people or to these systems, or we need to take actions here. So we provide the data, and then we work with our partners who then interpret that information and decide what to do with it.
And of course, it all has to happen very rapidly.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So the currency of Shake Alert is time. And so we're looking for ways, even if we're shaving off a tenth of a second, or even less than that, anything we can do to gain more time, improving the algorithms, improving how humans interact with the system, getting people to do things faster, is a worthwhile venture.
Well, I know a little bit about earthquakes, and I know that there are basically two types of seismic waves, the primary wave, which is the first to arrive, the P wave, and then the secondary waves, which are the second to arrive. Is it that it's detecting the P waves first that triggers the system? Is that how it works?
Exactly. Yeah, we don't know the earthquake is going on until those first seismic waves reach the surface. So the P waves are traveling on the order of 13,000 miles per hour. And as soon as they hit the surface, that's when the seismometers, the sensors pick up that ground motion. And that's when the system is triggered and everything goes automatically. And that's critical. The shake alert system is completely automatic. It has to be, because every second matters when it comes to shake alert.
Okay. Can you walk us through, you know, looking back at 1906, if that were to repeat itself exactly, which won't happen, you know, exactly, but if it were, knowing what you know about 1906 and the epicenter being, you know, just off the Golden Gate there, what would shake alert do? Can you kind of walk us through what would happen?
Yeah. So what's really important is, of course, we know that the event happened on the order of 2 miles off the coast, just off of the Golden Gate, right? And so we actually have one seismometer right at the Golden Gate Bridge. And so what would happen is that the earthquake started. And the one thing to really sort of sort out here is that we can talk about this in two different ways. First way we can talk about it is that in the history of the 1906 earthquake, one thing we know about is about 20 to 25 seconds or so before the main earthquake, before the magnitude 7.8 started, there was a foreshock. And by all accounts, and again, we didn't have the instruments like we do now, but by all accounts, there's the possibility that that foreshock would have triggered the shake alert system. So in that scenario, even the people really close to the earthquake, places like Oracle Park or Berkeley or Oakland, would have gotten an alert before the main earthquake happened, and they would have been able to do what they needed to do, protecting themselves, drop cover, hold on. BART would have done what it needed to do. All of these things would have happened. So in a foreshock scenario, which foreshocks do happen, they're frequent, everybody would have gotten alerts. And in this particular scenario, people all over the Bay Area would have gotten enough warning to do what they needed to do, but also very far away, places like Palo Alto and San Jose and those sorts of places would have gotten on the order of tens of seconds of warning time before shaking arrived at their location. And the cities that I'm choosing are close to the San Andreas Fault, about in the order of 12 miles or so. And they would have felt really heavy shaking because they're super close to the fault. Places like Berkeley and Oracle Stadium and Berkeley would have been what we call the late alert zone. And it turns out that most of those locations, super close to where the epicenter of the earthquake was, just off of the Golden Gate, probably would have resulted in people receiving the alert after they started feeling shaking. It's around San Mateo and somewhere in the order of, 22 miles from San Francisco. That's where we begin to start seeing where there's some alert times, where what we call positive alert times, where people will begin having a few seconds between when they receive the alert and when they start feeling the shaking.
Well, let's go through what should you do when you get one of these alerts.
The first thing we tell anybody to do is if you feel shaking or if you get a shake alert powered alert on your phone or you get an announcement is to drop cover and hold on. However, we know that a lot of it depends on where you may be. If you're in a car or if you're in a theater or if you're at the mall or even if you're in bed, there is protective action advice of what to do in specific situations. But it's all about knowing where you are and how to protect yourself. If you're already in bed, stay in bed, flip over, put your pillow over your head, protect your vital organs. Don't try to drop cover and hold on, because if you try to get out of bed, you may be thrown around anyway. But it's an idea of knowing where you are and having that situational awareness. But the default that we tell everybody is drop cover and hold on.
Well, and of course, you know, being one of the directors of this program, you get these alerts all the time. You were telling me a story earlier about a time you got a shake alert where it was kind of in an interesting situation. Could you briefly share that story with us?
So one of my roles is to manage communications around the shake alert system. And I run our social media and I tell people within a few minutes after the earthquake occurs and the system has done what it's going to do. And the most compromising position I've been in when I've gotten something coming on my phone is I was getting acupuncture and I was on the table and I had on the order of 30 needles in me and many of them were in my hands. And the expectation was, of course, is that I have to drop everything while I was lying there with needles in me and to respond. So it was kind of interesting doing the work that I do, but knowing that these needles were poking me in many different ways during the course of the response. So the acupuncturist got a little annoyed at the fact that I was doing this, but once I explained it to her afterwards, she completely understood.
Robert DeGroote, Shake Alert Operations Team Leader for the USGS, thanks for sharing this vital information with us, and let's hope the system works really well when the next big one does happen.
Thank you. Good talking with you.
Thanks again to all our guests from the United States Geological Survey, geophysicist Susan Huff, social scientist Sarah McBride, and Shake Alert Operations Team Lead Robert DeGroote. Special thanks to Paul Lausen from the USGS Public Affairs Office for helping to coordinate our interviews. If you missed part one of our special look back at the 1906 earthquake, you can check it out at mynspr.org. To learn more about earthquakes, from how you can prepare to how you can report if you feel one, visit usgs.gov. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.